رهن بس رندا راح تجي مع قهوة.
August 7th, 2016, I'm meeting today with Dr. Fadi Karim. Good morning, Dr. Fadi.
Morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So maybe we start, if you tell me a little bit about yourself, about your family.
Okay, my name is Fadi Abdul Karim. I was born and raised in Beirut, Lebanon, and I moved to Cleveland after getting married, 1 week after I got married in 1979. And we have been in Cleveland since, with the exception of a couple of years. In 84, 85, we were in Houston, Texas for training. And then I went back to Beirut, 85, and came back to Cleveland. And I've been since there, with the exception of 2011, when I went back to Beirut for 1 year. So totally, we've been here almost 37 years.
Okay, that's interesting. So you grew up in Beirut. If you can share with me, like, you know, how it like growing in that city. I mean, we hear a lot about Beirut.
So I grew up in 1954. Was born in 1954, and I lived in Beirut till 1979. Beirut in the 50s, 60s, and very early 70s was one of the most peaceful and most beautiful countries in the world. I have one brother, and I grew up with my parents, living in my parents' house, went to elementary school, high school, and medical school there, all in the same street. And we had all our family with us. Beirut changed in the 74 plus because civil war started, which was on and off. And when I left in 79, it was quiet. But then in the 80s, when I wasn't there, things really deteriorated. And so Beirut, during the 80s and early 90s, during civil war, there were, you know, families against families, neighbors against neighbors. Lebanon is a very small country. It's about, I would estimate, maybe 150 miles in length and about 80 miles in width. So it's very compact, very mountainous. And there were a lot of heavy weaponry and civil war going on. So there's a lot of destruction. But for Beirut itself, the destruction was mainly downtown. And when the war ended in the early 90s, 93, 92, that's where reconstruction of Beirut came about. And the reconstruction had to be in downtown for the infrastructure, went on till late 90s, and then Beirut became one of the most beautiful cities again. After they invested about $30 billion in it. Now it's a booming city, all modern and very pleasant to live in, except very expensive too.
Yeah. So why you decided to study, to attend medical school?
So I went to medical school at the American University of Beirut after graduating from International College, which is a private high school, right in continuity with the American University of Beirut. It's also an American institute. And I've been wanting to do medicine, and initially I thought I'd do neurology, and then by second year of medical school, I changed to pathology, which is laboratory medicine. And since the program was not accredited in Lebanon, my intentions were to come to United States, to Cleveland, to study pathology and then go back to practice pathology at the American University of Beirut.
And then if you can tell us about, you know, about your work now and in like the nature of your work and...
So pathology is one of those practices like radiology. We don't interact usually with patients face to face. We work in the labs. Most people think of pathology as autopsies, but I only did that in the training, haven't done autopsies for more than 20 years plus. There are two kinds of pathology. There's the what's called anatomic pathology or surgical pathology, and there's clinical pathology. Clinical pathology relates to everything you know about blood bank, microbiology, virology, chemistry, like getting a blood test for cholesterol, and molecular pathology, mainly genetic testing. So that's the laboratory pathology, which I don't do. I'm familiar with it and interact with it daily, but the main pathology I do is called anatomic pathology or surgical pathology and cytology. Surgical pathology is basically being right there next to the operating room, looking at specimens as they come out of the operating room and informing the clinician as to the findings so that they can proceed with the surgery. Or any patient that has any tissue removed, any biopsy removed for anything, whether it's a skin lesion or it's a major lung resection for cancer, all of any tissue removed from the patient, biopsy or big tissue, comes to pathology. We examine it grossly, we look at it, we take sections of it, we prepare slides, we look at slides, we issue reports as to the findings, we stage the patient, we do all the special studies that are needed for any sort of hereditary or personalized medicine. We present a complete report to the clinician and they discuss it with the patient and they decide on management. So pathology is involved in almost 80% of patients' analysis. And the other thing is cytology. There's a GYN cytology, which is basically somebody has to read the pap smears and the pap tests. So when a woman goes for her annual exam and gets a pap test or HPV testing, so somebody has to read all these pap tests. So we do that in the lab, and we also read in cytology any cells such as what's called needle aspirate, where they aspirate, for instance, a breast lump or a lung mass or under CT scan or under physical exam. We look at that and also any fluids such as lung fluid, abdominal fluid, you know, cerebrospinal, urine, any fluid that doesn't have tissue in it, we examine that and we also render an interpretation.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, you know, your involvement in the community here in general and then specifically with the Arab community in Cleveland. So to what extent you are involved?
Since we don't have thing we had in Lebanon, don't have here, is immediate family. So the Arab community becomes your family, basically. And, you know, the Arab community, we started together in 1979, so we're all recently coming to the States, and we're all residents and had modest means. And then gradually people worked very hard, and Arab community grew, and now 37 years later, the Arab community is very diverse. We've kept close contact with our people that we initially started with, and our kids and their kids, now second and sometimes third generation, are excellent friends. We have selected people that are close to us, and so this is part of our social life.
Okay, close to you socially or professionally?
Since I'm a physician, most of the Arab culture, people that I know are physicians, just because we trained together in different specialties, but we were in the same hospitals or in town. So most of them, I know them socially and I know them professionally. And professionally, I interact with them to various degrees, depending on how much they overlap with my specialty.
Yeah. So in your opinion, what are the, I mean, if you're involved with different like social classes within the Arab community, what are like the main challenges, like a typical Arab living in Cleveland has to face in this city?
I think the Arabs face challenges among themselves more than among living in Cleveland. So the same political things that were happening in the Middle East carry over here. So during the Lebanese War, most of our Lebanese friends, we had, you know, different opinions on what's going on and different philosophies. But we all buried that because that's more, our friendship is more important than any politics. So I don't think in any situation we had any conflict between each other, reflecting what was going on back home then. Now here, same thing happening, you know, the Syrian community might be divided, just like they're divided back home. Lebanese have an opinion on that. And so when we meet and we talk politics, obviously we're very different. Religion is not an issue because when we grew up in Lebanon, religion was never an issue. And so all our friends and family members, etc., were of a diverse religious affiliation and with intermarriages and everything. And even the war, which was under the heading of religion, had really much less to do with religion, but mainly politics and, you know, and different ideologies in the name of religion. So we didn't have any of this, you know, religion thing. And so we come here and each one keeps his faith and everyone is very respectful. And so that does not interfere with any of our friendships. Friendships are basically built on people who, you know, grew up together here, where kids were close to each other, and continues. That's what the main foundation.
I want to ask you about the role of Arabic culture and language in your life. I mean,
right,
how you see that?
So Arabic language in Lebanon is kind of different because we grew up speaking English and French from kindergarten, so there's no Arabic division. Your parents put you in either an English or a French division. And so all the sciences, everything was in English or French. Arabic was for literature and maybe history. And during your high school, you had to switch and learn 4 years of English if you're in the French division, and 4 years of French if you're in the English division, vice versa. So everyone grew up speaking three languages, plus the whole country speaks three languages automatically. So our Arabic wasn't as strong Arabic as we can put it. And even now the Lebanese school Arabic, if you watch TV or anything, is a hybrid of Arabic, English, and French. Used to be French predominant, now it's English predominant, taking over the French. And so even on TV, any newscast, anybody, the words interchange. Like, in contrast to my friends from the Arab world, such as Syria, they grew up learning Arabic and grew up learning medicine in Arabic. And so it was more difficult for them to translate that Arabic to English here. For us, we grew up in a country that all the sciences were in English, so we had no problem with anything. So it comes here to the Arabic language. You'd like to preserve the Arabic language when for your kids. But for my kids, we were not strict. So my kids understand now, they're all in their mid to late 20s and early 30s. They can understand everything in Arabic, colloquial Arabic, not literature, formal Arabic. They can understand any conversation to the extent possible. When they go back to Lebanon, however, everybody talks to them in English. They cannot speak Arabic. They can speak one or couple of words, couple of sentences, but we were not strict with them. Other families that were very strict, as they would only answer them in Arabic, one that till they went to elementary school and then the kids switched to English, so they'd answer you in English, but at least many of them do speak Arabic. So kind of different, and our kids now regret, they say, we wish you taught us Arabic. They are upset at us for not being more strict with them and teaching them Arabic.
Yeah. So if you mentioned your kids, can you tell us more about what they studied or what they're doing in their life?
So I have four kids, three boys and a girl, and my oldest, they all grew up here in Cleveland. They were all born in Cleveland except for my third was born in Atlanta, because that's the year I went back to Lebanon in 85. So we came back through Atlanta. And so they all grew up here. They all grew up in Cleveland. They consider Cleveland as their home. They all grew up in the same house. We're still in the same house. Now, first we were renting a house. But since 1989, they all grew up in Shaker. They went to elementary, middle school, high school in Shaker. Most of them went to public school. Only my first and parochial school, my first two, my son and my daughter, they went to Catholic school right next to our house. And then everybody moved to Shaker except for my oldest. He went to a private all-boys school. It all varied depending on the kids, none of them live here. They went to Ohio State, one went to Pittsburgh, then WashU, and one went to Case Western Reserve. So now my oldest is a lawyer in Boston. My daughter is a geriatric physical therapist. She's in West Virginia. My third is in Seattle. He's a computer engineer. And my youngest is now in San Francisco. He's has a doctorate degree in industrial and organizational psychology.
Mm.
Okay. So none of them are here.
But all of them grew up in this house.
They all grew up in this house, yes.
Okay, I want just to go back to the early years when you arrived in the United States, and specifically in Cleveland. So did you face any difficulties, if you can talk about certain difficulties?
So coming from Cleveland, people used to ask you if there's a cultural shock, all the way from did you have televisions to cars, etc. Actually, Beirut was more advanced than anything else. So Beirut can compete with any European or American any city any day. So no, we had no culture shock. We had every amenities and everything far in abundance than here. Cleveland in the 70s, early 70s was had a lot of issues downtown and security and all that. And so Cleveland over the years has boomed, and now Cleveland's a whole different city. For the past several years, amazing city, and it was nice bringing up family in Cleveland, because it's not a huge city like New York, and yet not a small suburb. And I think all my kids love Cleveland, and my wife really is very appreciative. And so, Cleveland is very nice. I don't think we had difficulties. Maybe the first 3 weeks we were here, just buying a car and getting our paperwork organized to settle down. And we got introduced to extended family. My father's cousin, who my father had only met him when they were 15 for 2 weeks in Lebanon. Otherwise, he doesn't know him. and my father's cousin, we communicated, we got introduced to him. He lives in Bay Village. He's second generation American and now the fourth generation. At that time, they were like family to us. So he and his wife were like, they were like our parents here, and for my kids were like their grandparents. Yeah.
How about
so that
your,
helped a lot.
But how about your siblings? Are they here, or living here, or in back home in Lebanon?
So I have one brother. He lives in Switzerland. He's been there for the past 4 years plus. He's a naturalized Swiss citizen, and his kids are Swiss. He speaks German, Arabic, and French fluently. He's basically Swiss, and so that's, I have only one brother. And my, as for my my wife's family, she has two brothers and two sisters. Two sisters, one is in Atlanta, one is in Madison, Wisconsin, lives 6 months here, 6 months in Beirut, but basically she lives in Madison and has taught for 30 years there at the school. Her two brothers, one of them is in California, in Malibu, is an engineer, and one of them is now in Dubai and moving back to Los Angeles. So when I go back home, really, my parents are deceased, and her parents, I stay, when I go to Lebanon, I stay in a hotel. I'm basically a tourist. I have no family except old friends that I try to communicate with. I've got two cousins that I'm close with, but otherwise I'm essentially a tourist living in a hotel and behaving like a tourist.
Yeah. So you mentioned your wife. How did you meet? Where?
So my wife and I go back a long way. We met when I was 15 and she was 13. And we met at a youth social group for the church, although we belonged to different churches, but it was mainly her church. A friend of mine invited me to come along, and so it was like a dancing party, and I met my wife then at a young age, and we've been together since, on a, you know, maybe most of the time, almost the time. And so after 10 years, from 15 till 25, 10 years of being boyfriend, girlfriend, and in Lebanon, we got married. I don't remember even proposing. And so we got married in Beirut, and then the next day we were at the American embassy getting a visa, and by the third day we were traveling to Cleveland. So she still says, where is the honeymoon? And I say Cleveland is the capital honeymoon city of the world, which she doesn't buy.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, you know, and if we compare the Arab community here with other communities, like of other immigrants, in terms of success, you know, do you think that the Arab experience in Cleveland is a story of success?
I think for the most, the Arab community of Cleveland is definitely a story of success. Depending, well, I the people I know have all been physicians almost, or highly educated people, and so they were very successful. They work 24 hours a day. They're very determined. They get along well with everybody, and so the people I know have been extremely successful socially, financially. The other Arab, or the Arab community that are moving here, you know, whether they have a store, whether they have a barber shop, whether they have anything, they're very successful because they're very dedicated, they're very hardworking, they're very sincere people. And so they work hard and they treat everybody with a lot of respect. They have no racial problems. And so we didn't grow up with any, you know, discrimination or anything, because it wasn't part of our culture. And so people like them, and so I think they're very successful, each in his own way. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't see them being a burden on anybody. In fact, they're all self-sufficient.
Yeah. So do you think that they contribute a lot to the cultural life, social, political life of the city?
I think they contribute a lot. I think culturally, just to start with food, for instance, when we came in, pita bread and anything Arabic or Lebanese wasn't even known. And now it's the health fad and everybody wants it. And they flock to the Lebanese and Arab stores on the west side. Culturally, they contributed a lot through their work. You know, they're very dedicated people, they're successful, and so they contribute financially. And and I mean, there's a culture here that's very nice, but
okay, very good. So I want to ask you, do you still consider yourself as an immigrant in many senses?
Yeah, this is a difficult situation.
Yeah.
Let's put it like this. For my kids, they don't consider them. They don't consider themselves immigrants. My kids consider themselves fully American, born and raised here. They have no problem saying that they're of Lebanese or Arab origin. They can voice their opinion. They're as fully assimilated in the system. They will not go back, you know. They like to visit Lebanon, and they're happy being there, but this is their home. For my wife, she's fully integrated here, much more than I am. So she, you know, built her home here, her children grew up here, everything. So she doesn't have the emotional attachment that I have to the extent to back home. For me, I'm torn, you know. I'm just basically, my work is here, my family's here, kids is here, I love being here. I also love being home. So even put me, took me 10, 15 minutes in Beirut, I'm very happy.
What do you exactly missing? You don't find here, you're missing when you see attachment.
Yeah, because when I go back, I grow back as a tourist. So that's a whole different situation. If I go back to live there, might be a different situation, you know. So I don't know. I miss I miss the streets. I miss the food. I miss just being myself, and I just feel like I'm more.
So do you think
more myself, basically?
Yeah, but sometimes you think as any immigrants. I mean, they're still haunted by their memories from their childhood.
No, I'm not haunted by any memories except good memories. So when I go back, I bring back the good memories.
No,
yeah.
I mean the good memories.
Yeah, so like my daughter was with me in Beirut 4 months ago in December, and she's like, Dad, and I remember every building and every street and every corner and every shop, and was telling her about everything. And she thinks I'm over romantic or whatever.
Yeah.
But, it's basically right now the reality. I went back in 2011. I took a sabbatical year and left my work at Case, and I went back and worked in Beirut for 1 year, but it was a 1 year commitment, and actually it was by myself. My wife and my kids were still here, and they would visit me, and I have nothing but good things. People say why did you come back, you couldn't tolerate it. Yeah, none of that is true, so it's fine.
So you like that?
Yeah, I lived for a year, and I was pleased.
Yeah.
But, it's hard to go back. You can't, for me, you can't drag your kids back your grandkids now back. You can make them proud of their heritage, but they did not grow up there. This is their home, so they have to be proud of their home here, and they have to have all their emotional attachment to here.
Yeah. But when you went for 1 year to Beirut, 2011, you say. I mean, do you think that things changed drastically, that you even you could not recognize certain
things? Oh yeah, no, Beirut. Oh yeah, definitely. So Beirut is as all this young generation. Basically, most of the population is younger than 30. So they are living it up. They party. They it's a crazy city. And for the older generation, Beirut has a lot of people like appearances and show off and cosmetic surgery, and they would never be seen unless dressing up the latest fashion or going to the fancy restaurants or driving fancy cars. Even if they're in debt, they will do that. It's very superficial culture. It's just all in appearances.
So how was the culture
So it was very different. Very different. Plus the city is changing. There isn't a single original building that's not being altered, demolished, with skyscrapers coming up, starting to look like Dubai. Except the difference is there are mountains and there are... So when you scratch the surface and look at the original people and the close friends, they're still the same. But when you look around, things have changed a lot.
Do you like it this way?
My kids and my wife think it's very superficial and they're not happy with it. I brush it off. I ignore it. And so I don't like dwell on it, but it is very different from that aspect. It's like the people went through 20 years of war, and for the past 10 years, 15 years, they just went crazy, basically, and no, with no inhibition and nothing, and a lot of money, and it's a different place.
I want to go back to your involvement in the Arab community here. Do you belong to any cultural clubs, Arab cultural clubs?
So there is the American University of Beirut alumni, and that is a huge community, and we belong to that. And so they have social events all the time
in Cleveland.
And then there are all sorts of Arab social events sometimes that come in but we don't like belong to any structural organization other than the alumni of the American University of Beirut. But I belong to some professional societies, such as I'm part of the International Academy of Pathology Arab Division. So this is a group of pathologists in the United States who are all of Arab descent. And there's a yearly conference in one of the Arab countries. And I've been involved in every aspect of that. I've been to every country presenting lectures and making workshops, Dubai, Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Syria, to name a few. I've been there with the Arab division there for a week, putting educational courses and interacting with the pathologists there and helping them out.
But did you present, did you have a conference here in Cleveland area?
We have, because there were diverse subspecialties, we don't have any conference related to the specialty area, but in Cleveland, I present part of my work at the Cleveland Clinic, basically, and conferences, but not anything specific. I've been giving a lecture recently, to several churches and whoever wants to listen, and it's called Lebanon in the Bible. And basically Lebanon is discussed more than 70 times in the Bible. So I go over Old Testament, New Testament, every area, and I show Lebanon then and Lebanon now. And people are really fascinated by that. And so I'm proud of that. I would like to present another talk about crossroads between Islam and Judaism and Christianity, talk about Lebanon, Damascus, and and Jerusalem, and I'm trying to put that together right now. Yeah.
Like, you know, which brings me to another question about, you know, what you do in free time. I mean, obviously doing these important lectures and about culture and history. But what other things that you like to find this balance between your profession and your spiritual cultural life?
So we're involved with our church, but it's an American church, Protestant church. And we are involved in the community, as in there's always events or dinners or weddings or things in the Arab community. And we got a lot of American friends. My wife much is a social person. Sorry, what was the question?
No, like, you know, for in your free time.
And my free time. Yeah. So I don't have a particular hobby. I always being pushed before I retire to develop a hobby, and I don't have a hobby. So I tried playing cards with my Arab friends, who are now once a month go and play poker and bridge, and I can't understand any cards. I tried joining them, I couldn't. Tried playing golf, I don't like it. So I don't have any much of hobbies. I like to bike, I like to walk. Sometimes I take kayaking, but there's nothing like I am dedicated to. So when I'm done with work, I just basically settle down and relax, and don't do much activities.
Yeah, we're coming close to this interview. I mean, I want to ask you from your experience, like as immigrants, Arab immigrants. I mean, what is your someone wants to come from the Middle East somewhere, an Arab. What do you
say? So I was reminded day before yesterday when somebody from the American University of Beirut wanted to apply to a training program here. And his CV had his middle name, which is Muhammad, and it had it in big letters. And somehow I instinctively told him to put his middle name as M. Because I felt like these days, if he sends that CV out for a job, as much as it pains me to say that, and I told him, and he knows that I'm saying that out of total respect and out of total love to him, that he may be discriminated upon. When I moved here with my name, Abdul Karim, obviously almost implying a Muslim name, that's what people associate. So people couldn't tell the Abdul, whether that's in my middle name, my hyphenated name, and so it was very difficult. And probably people still think I'm Muslim, but people thought I'm Muslim even in Beirut, and that's fine, and I never corrected anybody, and I still receive all sorts of, you know, wishes for every holiday, even now, from my Lebanese friends, and I respond courteously and respectfully, and I have all the respect for them. So, but it reminded me that when we came to Abdul Karim, when it came to my kids, we dropped the Abdul from the citizenship, and they became Karim. So it was easy for them to be, well, his name is William, so it's William Karim or Rania Karim, then Abdul Karim, and gradually all the Abdul Karim have become Karim here. And that is the, but I kept Abdul Karim, and I keep it in all my publications, my professional presentations. And I don't know what people think. I never worry about it for a second. Mm. And I just...
Yeah, because this is unusual, actually. Because yeah. Abdul Karim, I also, when I saw it first time, I thought you were a Muslim. So how you got this name, last name, if you...
So basically, we go back to the 1800s. The Abdul Karim have... I don't know how the name came. Abdul means servant, and Karim is generous, so servant of the generous, which is God. The family started in 1800. That's where a history I have, and they were at that time Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox, two brothers who were ministers, were priests, and one of them converted to Protestantism way back then, in the late 1800s in Lebanon. And he didn't like the fact that in the Eastern Orthodox churches there are statues and icons and pictures, because he said there shouldn't be any pictures and they should worship only God directly, and that's the first commandment. And so he split, he became Protestant, and since then there's a generation of Protestants. My grandfather was the head of the Presbyterian Church in the Middle East. Even when I was in Cairo, people recognized him, just well known in Syria, well known in Jordan, everywhere. And so he was the head of the church, extremely liked person. Three of my aunts married to Protestant ministers, so I grew up. I don't remember any other thing. So it's, yeah, but my first name, Fadi, is basically Redeemer, which refers to Christ. And so it's kind of in the Arab world, it's kind of nobody knows, you know, and I never explain it, and I never thought about it. But it's true. When we were in Morocco, we were with the tourist guide, and he at noon wanted me to go in the mosque and pray with him. And I said, please go ahead and pray, and I'll wait for you with my family outside. And he insisted and insisted. And I said, respectfully, you know, go ahead, please pray for us and go in. And then finally I had to tell him that I'm not Muslim, and he got extremely upset that because my name is Abdul Karim, I'm denying my faith.
Oh.
And I'm not. And so anyhow,
yeah.
I'm sure people, when they see it, whether, but you know, I worked hard, and I have numerous publications and book chapters and books and editors, and so my specialty people know my name, and so I don't wink about it.
Okay, so the last thing I will ask you about, you know, final thought you want to, things that you want to say, or because, you know, as you know, this is like as a part of the project about the Arab community.
I think it's very important that, in retrospect, that the kids in second generation keeps excellent roots, including speaking their language. They should have been much more strict about that, so they should know. They should definitely visit their homeland, absolutely. I don't understand, like, my in-laws, through my son's in-laws, who are originally Lebanese, my next-door neighbor, whose mom is Lebanese, that they never go back, and I don't know why, to Lebanon. And that, I think, is extremely important, because once my kids went back, even in the 90s when the war was just over, they don't remember destruction or anything. They, you know, it's all in the way you present it. And now, you know, once they went back several times, and they only go back for a week, so it's like, you know, a week and a half as tourists, then they come back with a whole different perspective. Nobody can say anything about their culture, about their country, in any way that they're like, oh, there was a war in Beirut, Beirut is destroyed, or it's unsafe or anything. They know very well that it is safe and there's no war. It's very well built, and people are very friendly, and it's very safe. So that is very important. If you don't do that step, but this is very similar to any American who never traveled out of the United States. You know, once they travel, they get. But it's important that they speak the language. It's important that they transmit that to their kids, which is fading away, obviously. It's important that they visit and they maintain their culture. And, you know, in a way, when my son is studying psychology, then said there's this 6 or 7 degree, I don't remember, of separation, where if you meet somebody after six people, you eventually know somebody they know or you become related. When he's in Lebanon, he says there's 1 degree of separation. You meet somebody, you talk to them, then you realize you're related to them. Doesn't matter which religion, yeah. Which area of town. And that is true. That's true.
Yeah. Okay, I would like to thank you for this wonderful interview. And I wish you a nice day.
Thank you. Thank you.